God bless the Churchills. What a great pastor and pastor's wife and family you have here. And it's just, I just enjoyed it. It's been good to be here. We have enjoyed it. Amen. Now we are going to do something that wasn't originally on the schedule, but I feel like it's very, very important. I want to talk to you about the age of the earth, because this is what the evolutionists have to have. They have to have eons and eons of time, or the whole theory falls flatter than a pancake. It falls flatter than a pancake anyway. It falls like a piece of paper. All right. Now, we covered, if you remember, the fossils. And this is one of the things that some people get fooled by. They say, well, we found this fossil, and this fossil is 70 million years old. So if the fossil is 70 million years old, surely then the Earth has got to be older than that. Have you ever heard that line? You know, they always find it. Okay. I don't know if you've ever seen this cartoon, but this is funny, but it's very true. This guy, he asks the other guy, first of all, he says to the guy, this fossil is 3 billion years old. And the guy asks a reasonable question, well, how do you know it's 3 billion years old? And look at the answer he gives. He says, well, it was in this rock strata. Oh, well, how can you be certain of the age of the rock strata? And then he answers, well, this 3-billion-year-old fossil was in it. And the guy looks kind of confused. And truthfully, this is so. Evolutionists date the rocks, or the geologists date the rocks by the fossils they find in it. And the paleontologists date the fossils by what rock it's in. That's called circular reasoning. And I want to say that's not the highest form of logic by any means. So this is just sad. Okay, now, I mean, you go to a lot of places, and this is all over the world. Jade and I had the opportunity to go to New Zealand a few years ago, and we visited the, I don't know if I can pronounce it, the Waitomo Glow Worm Caves. And, of course, all the information was that these caves were 30 million years old. So we saw something 30 million years old. Hogwash. Okay. And, of course, you go in the cave and you see all these stalactites and stalagmites. I'm not enough of a geologist to know the difference. The one grows from the top and one grows from the bottom. But anyways, but you know what? This is a picture of a bat that was preserved in a stalagmite. Now, I say this, either it was a mighty slow bat, or else it doesn't take long for cave formations to form. Can you imagine that bat sitting there 30 billion years while that stuff dripped on it? No, it doesn't take long. Here's some evidence of it. In a railroad cave thing, I mean, that they dug underground, some kind of a tunnel, and they know that they dug this tunnel like in 1850, and there wasn't these stalactites and stalagmites, but just because of the dripping soil, these things, they know, are less than 150 years old. So it was formed by the solution that found in an abandoned gold mine tunnel. I had railroads in Australia. Okay. And so people have found out that caves can be formed very rapidly, and it depends on, and I'm going to get complicated right now, but the amount of carbon dioxide in the solution, the pH, that's the acidity. For those of you chemists, that's the negative logarithm, the hydrogen ion concentration. Okay, the oxidation of organic matter, the temperature, the pressure, and especially the concentration of the solutions that drip through, and the rate of the solution flow. And that's what depends on it takes. So if it's very slow, it would take longer to form. If it's fast, it's going to take a lot faster. So caves can form in a very short time. Don't be led to think that cave was 30 million years old. And so much for what's called uniformitarianism. We mentioned this the other night. I think it's very significant. Mount St. Helens was a very beautiful mountain in Oregon. And I used it in illustration of the energy involved to blow up the top. But let's go another thing. This is what it looked like, as I mentioned to you, this is what it looked like before the eruption. And this is what it looks like as this is actually a picture of the day before it exploded. And you can see that bulge forming. And it was forming for a few days. And, of course, they warned everybody to get out of there. And there were probably people that didn't heed the warning and were killed by this. All right. This is May 18th, and the next day when it blew its top. And this is a picture of what it looked like after it blew its top. Okay? And I think I got some pictures here of the trees that were blown over by the blast. These all were floating in Spirit Lake. This is an aerial view of it. You can't see very well, but the whole lake was covered by trees. And what is amazing is some of the mudslides and the canyons that were dug out in days, you know, by the mudslides from this eruption. Here's a picture of the mountain before, and here's a picture from the same angle after. And here's some more pictures before and after. Okay, but what I really want to get out of this, and why it's so significant, is that it showed that great amounts of geologic work can be done rapidly. And it was many geologists saw things that they thought would take thousands and millions of years, and it happened in hours and days. In fact, some people called Mount St. Helens a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. In other words, the canyons that were formed in just a short amount of time, this is probably the mechanism that the flood and some of the things happened. But it shows that things can be done very rapidly. Okay. So it helps on a small scale imagine what the biblical flood might have been like. Some of the effects, stratification, the layers. They could see these layers, but, you know, the rock was formed in hours, and they used to think each layer was like 1,000 years or something, and it was just minutes. The erosion, like those canyons dug out. The uprighted logs that were floating in the lake, you know, this way first. After a while, they floated so they would be vertical and then sink at various times. And that's a good explanation for the petrified forest in Yellowstone. That they, you know, go down and sink. And they've gone under, you know, scuba dive underneath there and saw them plant on the bottom. And the peat layer at the bottom could have been the first stages of coal formation. So that's why it just shows things can happen in a short period of time, not as millions and billions of years. Now that we showed this slide, the basic theory of evolution is that, you know, several billion years ago, particles finally evolved into elements and then complex chemicals and finally man, as we showed this picture, which is good to you. That's their idea. But it requires huge time elements of time. Now, there are two major foundations that evolution rests on. And the two major foundations are what we're talking about now, time, eons of time, and the other foundation is chance. And Wednesday night, I think it was, we talked about the probability of life occurring by chance. And if you remember, we said the probability of life occurring by chance is less than a tornado passing through a junkyard producing a modern aircraft. Or we said the probability of life is less than an explosion in a print shop producing an unabridged dictionary. So what I'm saying is if we took the time and showed you that Wednesday night, that mathematically evolution is improbable, so that what that is doing is showing beyond doubt that when you see something complex, like in living systems, you can be sure it was designed. It didn't happen by accident. And without a living God, life could never come into existence. So, what two foundations does evolution rest on? Well, time and chance. And we took, as I said, Wednesday night, spent a lot of time destroying this foundation of chance. And so that's one of the towers that's collapsed. Okay, now, today we're going to attack this tower of time. And we've already mentioned some things like cave formation. Now, probably the one you hear the most, when I do one session in church, which I do often, not a series, but I do some series, but lots of times I just do one session and it opens the question. There are two questions. Jane, you can vouch for it. Almost every time you're going to get two questions. One is, what about the dinosaurs? And we covered that. What night did we cover that? Yesterday, Friday night, okay? And the other one is radiometric dating. And I say, what about radiocarbon dating? Have you ever heard that radiocarbon dating shows that the Earth is millions of years old? How many have ever heard that? Okay. Well, the fact of the matter, let me just say right off, if you ever hear anybody say this, you know for sure that person doesn't know what they're talking about. Because even radiocarbon dating is not used to date rocks. It's used to date things that were once alive, like bones or trees. So when somebody says radiocarbon dating says the Earth is older, they don't know anything about radiometric dating. Okay, now I'm going to give you a chemistry lesson. Thank God our star student is here today. What is her name? I didn't catch it. Holly. Holly, now you've had chemistry then, I gather. Okay, what am I showing here? And what is the periodic table of what? The elements. Okay, now I'm going to give you a little chemistry lesson. If you remember, I took a piece of aluminum and tore it up and said the very smallest particle of aluminum has the property of aluminum was an atom of aluminum. Okay, then that atom has a nucleus, a center, and in the center there are, according to atomic theory, protons and neutrons. That's in the nucleus. And then there are electrons surrounding it. Now you identify an element by the number of protons it has in it. In other words, any element of carbon has 6 protons. Any element of hydrogen has 1 proton in the nucleus. Any element of helium has 2. Any element of any atom of nitrogen has 7. So that's called the atomic number. Okay. Now, when we get this may be a little complicated, but carbon 12 has 6 protons. By far and away, all of the carbon atoms have 6 protons. But there are some that have 8 protons. And that is, right, what we call carbon 14. Where do we get the carbon 12? You add 6 plus 6, 6 protons, so 6 neutrons, it is carbon 12. Carbon 14 also has 6 protons. That's still a carbon atom, but in this case, carbon 14 has 8 neutrons. Now, it turns out carbon 12 is very stable. That's what almost all is. But carbon 14 is radioactive and it decays eventually into carbon 12. So that's these two, the carbon 12 and carbon 14, are both carbons, but they're called isotopes. One having 14 weight, atomic weight of 14 with 8 neutrons and 6 protons. And this radioactive isotope decays, giving off some form of radiation. So carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope. Now, as I said, that is used sometimes to determine the age of bones and trees and things which are once alive. So they do have methods to try to determine the age of the Earth. And one of them is called potassium-argon decay, and another they use is uranium to lead. And these are a couple of other methods. It turns out there is an expression which I didn't define yet. That's called the half-life. the amount of time it takes for a pound of carbon-14 to decay to a half a pound is called the half-life. And the half-life happens to be like 5,760 years, plus or minus 30 years. The time it takes for potassium to decay to argon, if you have a pound of potassium, the time it takes to become a half a pound is 1.3 billion years. That's a long time, isn't it? Okay? So that's what's called a half-life. Now I'm going to tell you why this is how this is used somewhat. It's used to date then the age of rocks and sediment. Now, this slide may be a little complicated, but if you use this half-life and you assume the rate is constant, you can attempt to try to determine the age of the sample. And that's what they do. Now, here's the key. Here's the key. There are three, and you don't hear this, most people don't know this. There are three major assumptions in radiometric dating. Number one is they have to assume that when that moose dies out there, you know, if they're trying to determine the age, they have to assume that they know, or at least they found a bone, let's say a bone that they think was a 1,000-year-old moose or something like that, they have to assume they know what the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12 was when it died. And the uranium lead, they assume there's uranium but no lead. Of course, that's a sad problem because they couldn't God have created lead as well as uranium? And then the other thing is, the other thing is they assume that the change in concentration only occurs by radiometric dating. But if you have some uranium or lead or some bones in there, can't some leach, the chemicals leach in and leach out? You're like acidic soil, maybe 99% of stuff can leach out of it. So that's another poor assumption. But probably the poorest assumption of all is the rate of decay is constant. I said that carbon-14 decays, if you have a pound, it takes 5,760 years to use a half pound. Who's been observing it for 5,760 years? I mean, they didn't even think of radiometric dating until much over 100, 200 years ago. And especially there for when you date the age of the Earth, who's been measuring that a pound of potassium decays to a half a pound in 1.3 billion years? I mean, nobody can assume that. Then there's no instrumentation that's accurate enough to even measure, you know, anywhere near the sensitivity. So because of these assumptions, you get some terrible errors. For example, they took some snails in New Mexico just to experiment on this and dated with the shells and found out they were supposed to be 27,000 years old and they just took them, they were alive. Okay? They took some clams and found dates like 1,000 years old. I think these were in Alaska, some seal carcasses that they found 30 years ago. They were 30 years old when they'd been dead, and they came up with dates like 4,600 years, and then they took some living seals and killed them in 1,300 years. You get some terrible errors. And then rocks. They have taken samples of rocks from this one place in Hawaii, this particular mountain that they know erupted in 1801, and they came up with dates of 160 million to 3 billion years, where they know the rocks were only 200 years old. But more recently than that, I don't have a picture of that, you remember me saying that Mount St. Helens erupted May 18, 1980. In 1992, these rocks were 12 years old. Somebody decided to take some of these samples to a laboratory that did radiometric dating to determine how old the rocks were, but they didn't tell them they were 12-year-old rocks. And they came up with things like hundreds of millions of years old, and they were 12 years old. So what I'm saying is they don't publish this. Every book, textbook in California has to say the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and I went to the school district and looked at the geology, looked at the earth science, looked at the biology book, looked at the chemistry book, looked at the physics. They all have that data because they have to. It's a requirement of state law that your books have to conform to this science framework. We have been hoodwinked because of a religion, not a science, but a false religion, and it has been propagated upon our children and destroyed their faith in the B-I-B-L-E, the book for me, and as a result, we've got just handfuls of believers instead of the whole country being a Christian nation. We've got more than handfuls, but it's just sad what's happened. So the conclusion is that dates obtained by radiometric dating, they may be an interesting geophysical exercise, but they do not determine the age of the Earth. How do we determine origins? We ask who? The one who was there, right? And he recorded it in what? The B-I-B-L-E, that's the book for me. That's where, this is reliable history. What I'm showing you, Pastor, that's science falsely so-called because nobody has ever observed the date of the Earth. Now, I don't know what's taught in the schools here, but I doubt you get a lot of this evolutionary slant here. I'd be surprised if you didn't. Now, let me show you. If you take the same assumptions, for example, you take the same assumption of uniform rate of decay, there's a lot of things that would indicate a young Earth. In fact, over 100 things of it. I've got one article, 101 things that would show a young Earth. Unfortunately, they take some of the same assumptions, but let's just talk about it. Probably, for example, the Earth's magnetic field has been measured longer than radiometric dating because it was, I think, Carl Gauss, and I forget what, about 1832, discovered that the Earth's magnetic field was decreasing. Magnetic strength can be measured. You all have probably, and I didn't look closely at Sister Churchill's refrigerator, but many homes you go into, you see magnets put on refrigerators. How many got magnets on your refrigerator? Okay, they got some there too. You can, if you want to, you can peel those magnets off, can't you? They aren't very strong magnets. But there are magnets which you can actually lift cars with in junkyards. So the strength of a magnet can be measured. The magnetic field of the Earth, the strength can be measured also. Not only does it, turn the compass toward the north, but the strength of it can be measured. And they have found, and they've been measuring this, I think it was 1835. I've got my book. I don't remember the exact date. But they've been measuring that since probably the longest thing they've measured as far as a geophysical type thing. And this chart here plots how it has decreased. I have another slide, and I've covered it up, but which shows the data that they have. They've only been measuring it since, like, by 1835. But they have come up with, because of that curve and plotting at a logarithmic that is decreasing in a logarithmic fashion, and it has a half-life of 1,400 years. So if you took that back, that would mean that 600 AD would have twice the magnetic field, would have twice the strength. 800 BC would have four times the strength. You get down to the time of Christ, before Christ, probably about 30 times the strength. Okay, now, what that's saying, that wouldn't cause, 30 times wouldn't cause a whole lot, but if we had been here millions of years, and you were, which way's north of here? North of here? I'm confused. That way? So if you were chopping wood like that, maybe it would swing your axe through there. If you're trying to sail a boat this way, it would go up this way. I mean, the magnetic field would be so strong. In fact, they have estimated if the Earth was 20,000 years old, the strength would be so, it would cause such heat that we couldn't live on here. So this is one thing that they use, a similar type of assumption, to show a very young Earth. Another one that's probably more simple to you, how do you date a tree? Yeah, you count the trees, rings, don't you? Dendrochronology, big term, dendron, tree, chronos, time, logos, study. So the dendrochronology is a field of study that uses annual growth rings to establish dates. Now, what causes tree rings? in the springtime right now, new wood is growing between the old wood and the bark. And trees grow rapidly, at least in some areas. Okay, in the summertime, it starts to slow down, and what happens in the winter stops growing. And then it starts again next spring. This is what causes the rings in a tree. So if I took this Douglas fir and I wanted to, you know, cut down a tree and I wanted to know how old it was, I just count the number of rings. That's not entirely accurate. Sometimes you can have an unusual spring where it gets real warm and then you get a real cold spell again. You can possibly have a couple of rings, but it's pretty close. You know, usually it's pretty close. You count, you get a very, very good estimate of the age of a tree by cutting it down and counting it. And so here we have a case of a guy with a chainsaw cutting a tree and cutting sandwich. You get a pretty good idea, especially if you cut it down toward the bottom. So if you want to know how old that tree is in your front yard, just cut it down. But the problem is some people don't want to cut their trees down. So how do you date a tree without cutting it down? Well, it's very difficult. They have what they call increment borers, and they screw this thing into the tree, and they take a sample, and out comes a sample like a smaller than a pencil as far as thickness, and that sample, they can count the rings. But the problem is they can only go in about 12 inches. So you really have a poor... You got to assume, you know, kind of a uniform growth rate. So you really have a hard time with increment borer determining the date. So if I wanted to determine this giant sequoia's date, it'd be a little difficult. You can't, because you can't just measure the diameter, because that has to do with how much sunlight the tree gets, how much rain it's in the area, how many other trees are nearby that block out the nutrients and so forth. So the best way is to count the rings. Okay, now some trees are really difficult. They claim the oldest trees are the White Mountains in California, and it's a bristlecone pine. And you can see what a snarly tree that is. Even if you cut that down, this one's called Methuselah, supposed to be the oldest, you know, oldest tree. Well, they're guessing at it because they haven't cut it down. In fact, you can't even get near it, because they don't want anybody to disturb it. But anyway, at the oldest, you know, the tree, they somewhere 4,000 to 5,000 years old. And it's interesting that if you take approximate date of the oldest trees, you come up with a date about the time of what? Noah's flood. And so we believe that this flood destroyed the whole surface of the earth. We think that the fossils, the coal, for example, is the fossilized remains of coal plants. So the tree, oldest trees, somewhat, you know, very closely approximate the date of the flood when most of the trees were destroyed. I think some survived. I feel like one must have survived because Noah, you know, when he sent out that dove, came back with a leaf in it. But most of them were destroyed. Okay. Then how did trees survive? You know, how did they come back again? Well, the seeds and so forth floating and finally then settled and then reforested areas. It is interesting that they have found many places what are called polystrate fossils. These are trees, you know, where they've got layers of rock. Now, they used to think, well, each inch took thousands of years, you know, before Mount St. Helens. But they have a real problem with this, because if this took hundreds of thousands of years, wouldn't that tree have rotted in that time? This indicates that this tree is very red, that this strata formation took place in a very, very short time to have caused this tree to be going through many layers of rock. It couldn't grow through many layers of rock. You don't have a tree underneath the 15, 20 feet of rock growing through the rock, you know, unless it was a crack. I also showed you, I think it was Wednesday night, that population statistics confirmed that man hasn't been here very long. And I showed you if man had been here millions of years, what would have happened? You would have been crushed, wouldn't you? Okay, so that confirms, younger. This isn't one of the 101 things the guy in his article. There's more than that. Evidence is for a young earth. Now, and if there had been no flood, we started our calculations there. We started with 8 people repopulating the earth. Remember that was the 8th and doubled to 16 and so forth. But if you start with 2, but you go back another 1,500 years, if you started with 2 people with that same growth rate of only 0.5% a year, we would have 2.5 trillion people on the face of the earth. That's 500 times the present population. Remember we saying that there was, if we had been here just 9,000 years, we would have 4,000 people per square foot? Now, if we had been here just the time since Adam, if there had been no flood, which they try to discount, we would have 500 times. What's 500 times 4,000? What, a couple million people per square foot? Oh, now let's talk some other dating methods. You all are aware that of what's called the hydrologic cycle, and you have the I could start with the ocean. The ocean evaporates, forms clouds. The wind blows the clouds over the land, and then precipitates as rain, or in some places snow, like Alaska, and then that melts, runs in the rivers, it washes into the ocean, and then the ocean evaporates. Greatest water purification system in the world, free. Okay, pure water evaporates, clouds, rains again. But what happens when that water runs down into the sea? What does that do as it passes through the earth? What? It brings sediment. It also dissolves chemicals. That are in there. Like salt and so forth, dissolves chemicals. So what's happening? The ocean is getting a lot more dirt in it. The oceans are becoming saltier. And they have measured the concentrations of chemicals. And they have seen the sediment becomes. Okay, so what happens is the sediments, the ocean is sort of getting the layers of sediment are building up in the ocean floor. The chemical concentrations are increasing. And river deltas, such as, I think that's the next slide. This is an aerial view of around Los Angeles. And Brother Charles is from Louisiana, and he would be aware of this. They claim that the Mississippi Delta is increasing 1/16th of a mile a year. You remember what? They said Los Angeles, New Orleans. I'm sorry. Thank you. I got a good wife. She corrects me, and I need correct. New Orleans. I thought I said Louisiana, but maybe I didn't. Okay. Yeah, but okay, tough. Los Angeles is in Louisiana. Boy, I'm ignorant with my geography, aren't I? Okay, anyways, this Mississippi Delta there near New Orleans is increasing about 1/16th of a mile a year. In other words, about every 16 years increases a mile. Now, if the flood is, 4,500 years and divide that by 16, years per mile, 300 miles is not an unreasonable thing. But if we'd been millions of years, that delta would be millions of miles long. You know what I mean? So that's, now, that's assuming a uniform rate. Some chemicals have showed very young, the increase is very little, like the very young earth. Well, these depend on what the water passes through, what's in the soil, and so forth. But anyways, what I'm saying, this type of calculation shows the earth to be very young. Here's one. Most of the helium in the earth's atmosphere is produced by radioactivity in the Earth's crust. A helium atom, the nucleus of it, is an alpha particle. Okay, so that, when it evolves, when it, you know, passes into the Earth, it forms helium, helium gas. Now that again may be a little bit complicated, but if the rate of helium flow was constant, if the Earth would have been billions of years old, as they say, we'd have over a million times more helium in the atmosphere than we have right now. So the lack of helium in the Earth's atmosphere also gives evidence of a young Earth. Very little helium escapes into space. It's in the atmosphere. This is one that I'm putting in my book when I'm revising it, and it's in the process of updating it, is Niagara Falls, because I think this is very, very easily understandable. They have, people living in this area have measured how much Niagara Falls is sort of like a glacier, you know, in that you have ice breaks up and the glacier recedes. Well, Niagara Falls, because of erosion and so forth, rocks drop off, and the Niagara Falls has been moving backwards, and the gorge has gotten longer. Now, they have, if at a uniform rate, which is, they've measured somewhere 3 to 5 inches, or 5 feet a year that has averaged, the falls breaking off. You're talking for a gorge being about 7 miles long. You're talking, again, close to the date of the flood. Not billions of years, but close to the date. So the fact that the gorge is not thousands of miles long, it's another indication, hey, you haven't been here so long. Okay. The coal and oil. I know we were even taught in Bible school at after the fifth day or whatever the trees were singing and took and that therefore the earth was very old. Many people think it takes millions of years for coal to form, but they have formed coal from cellulosic material. Have formed coal in hours in laboratories. There's a school called Utah School of Mines that I have a document where they formed coal in just hours by the right combination of temperature and pressure. What could have caused that temperature and pressure? The flood. Same thing, oil. They've converted garbage and manure into oil in hours. I'm not saying that's an economical process, otherwise we might we might use that rather than ethanol, corn. Anyways, what I'm saying is, again, it doesn't take a long time for coal and oil to form. And I feel like oil is the remains of trapped marine creatures. What could have caused the pressure? What caused the temperature to convert the coal, the trees into coal and the marine stuff into oil? Well, the temperatures and the pressures could have been generated by the friction and the pressure caused by the sediments of the flood. So that, again, is not evidence of an old Earth. Okay, we just mentioned, give me a very, very short time. Burial and friction resulting from Noah's flood can generate temperatures and pressures necessary to convert vegetable mineral material into coal in a short time, and oil likewise, and I've already talked about that. So on what two foundations, I'll make sure it fit with your time frame. What two foundations does the theory of evolution rest? Time and chance. We showed that the probability of life occurring by chance is less than a tornado crossing through passing through a junkyard producing an airplane. Mathematical probability of life occurring by chance, zilch. How about time? They need billions of years. We've showed that. They do not have evidence at all for an old Earth. So what foundations does it rest? Absolutely nothing. I just want to say, what I'm teaching today is hated by evolutionists. anybody who teaches a young earth is despised by an evolutionist. Because they know without eons of time, their whole theory collapses. Sad. How old is the earth? Well, remember we've shown when the first man was created? Remember that? What did we say the first man was created? About 6,000 years ago, and trying to drill this back. How did we get 6,000 years? We took the what? The genealogies. Adam was 130 years old, and begat Seth, and Seth was 105 years old, and begat Enos. They added those up, got to time of the flood, got to Abraham, got to Solomon's temple. By a combination of genealogies and history, we show man has been here approximately 6,000 years. Okay. But what about the earth? Does the Bible give any indication of the age of the earth? I think I got the scripture already on there. Jesus said this. From the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Now, what did evolution say? Remember me saying, evolution say the earth is 4.6 billion years old. They say man came on the scene about 3 million years ago. So you're talking about in the last, actually 1 over 1250, let's say the last 1,000th period. They say in the last period, 1,000th period of Earth's history, man came on the scene. Did Jesus say at the very end of man's, of the Earth's existence, God created the male and female? Jesus said from the beginning. So it was at the beginning of creation that man was created. So how old is the earth? If man is 6,000 years old, when people ask me that, I say, well, if man's 6,000 years old, then earth is about 6,000 years and 6 days. You know, but it's about the same, you know, it's relative time. So at the beginning, that was in the beginning. In the beginning, God created the earth. In 6 days, he formed the earth to be inhabited. So when was the first man created? 6,000 years ago. When was the earth created? 6,000 years plus 6 days. Okay. Let's stop. It's a good time. You're going to feel more. Does anybody have any water for me? They could get me some water. I hate for the church I'll have to do it, but somebody could just get a. Here, Kim's got one. Great. Thank you. This is a good time, we got in Sunday school, a good time to ask you some, or to allow you to ask some questions. Thank you, brother. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. John Craig is raging. Gary Parker, who is in Florida, he speaks on evolution. He's a teacher of evolution, evolutionary biology. There's a tremendous video series that. Trying to think of the guy's name, but he took. Yeah, and he it's called Incredible Creatures That Defy Evolution. And he wrote a book, The Evolution of a Creationist. But he taught at a university and was teaching evolutionary dinner. He was at a dental school. One of the large universities in Louisiana. And the students came up to him and said, do you know the assumptions involved in. And is radiometric dating, and you know, what assumptions? He didn't think, but he thought, well, I'll check it out, and I'll prove the students wrong. And he claimed it took him about 5 years to finally see that. There's quite a few. This idea of the mathematical probability. You see, anybody who is honest, you know, you can't even look at the stars The heavens declare the glory of God. You can't even look at the stars and be honest and think that they evolved. You have to be. Let's see. I think I've got a next slide after this. Let me just see if I've got this. Just a second. I think I've got it on here. Oh, this is not it. Maybe it's not on here. Let's just see. Oh, cool. I guess it's not after here. Anyways, I was going to say, why do people believe in evolution? I think first and foremost, they believe in evolution because they were taught by it. They were taught by it by somebody that seemed knowledgeable. You know, you get a first grader, and if your wife was teaching first grade, a first grader would think, boy, she is a genius. I mean, you know, this lady knows everything. You know, so how could she be wrong? You know, she's teaching it. Now, your wife wouldn't teach it. What I'm saying is that's the way, you know, I think you were telling me about how the ages, different ones relate and think of the teacher. Well, then why did that teacher believe it? They sat in at some university. And we're taught it by PhDs, you know, with lots of education and maybe good teaching methods. And so the most people believe in evolution because they were taught it. That's what most of them are. You know, I don't mean to be wrong or conceited or anything, but most people have not heard what you have heard this week, have never heard it or never read it, never even dawned it. They just accept it by fact, this evolutionary thing. And that's why I would like to see. I mentioned Brother and Sister Grohman teaches. I would like to see 100 people in our movement teach it, because this is foundational. What you do with Genesis, you can do the rest of the Bible. I'm just kind of running on here, but Genesis is a foundation for marriage. Do you know that?
Yes.
Very, very first. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother. Genesis is a foundation for modesty of dress. See, when they sin, they realize they need to be covered. And their idea of covering wasn't enough. You know, God covered. God believes in modesty of dress. I mean, almost everything you believe. The promise of the Messiah, the seed of the woman is going to bruise the serpent's head. You go through the Genesis, the foundation. And that's the book the devil is destroying and destroying it in our school system. Okay? And the media.